Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, a spotlight on Latter-day Saint missionary safety after sexual assault survivors ask the church to make changes. Also, members of a Utah-based polygamist group are indicted in a tax credit scheme, and a donation to Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes gets scrutiny. And despite calls from critics and from the governor to be transparent, subcommittees of the Inland Port Authority will remain private. And joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham is here. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
And also Digital News Editor Rachel Piper. Good morning, Rachel, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's been a long time.
Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments on any of the stories that we're covering today. You can call us at 801-355-8255 or post them at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. I'm also going to welcome to the studio, just a tad late, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Good morning.
Good morning. Rachel Piper, you published a pretty striking two-part series this week about the sometimes dangerous lives of people who go on missions for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You highlight stories of two young women who served in missions, one in Mexico, one in Bolivia, and they had traumatic experiences while on their mission, each of them. Before we turn to the broader implications, let's start with these experiences. Who are these women, and tell us just what happened to them?
Camille Junca, she was called to Mexico. It's called the Cuernavaca Mission, and part of that mission covers the state of Guerrero, things I'm not pronouncing very well, but that's Mexico's most dangerous state and has been since 2013, I believe. She was serving in that state when 43 students were kidnapped and turned over to police and then turned over to a crime syndicate and killed. And missionaries were sent back into that area. And the day that she was sent back, she was in her apartment with her companion. Two men came in and assaulted them both.
This is day one of her being
back in that area after having been evacuated for a few weeks after violence erupted after those kidnappings. Maddie Seacott, the following year, she was in Bolivia. And she and her companion were out on the street and had an appointment with a inactive member who, you know, wasn't there. And then they were invited to come teach a man who said that his family was home, that they were inactive, that they were hoping to have the missionaries come teach them. So, you know, really eager to find another person to teach, they went in with him. He took them down to the basement and at knife point threatened Maddie to strip naked and was clearly about to assault her when she and her companion were able to break free from that and get help out on the street.
Those are difficult stories, and part of the reporting that you did was on what happened in the wake of those attacks in each instance. And this is kind of at the heart of the story because you've got mission presidents in these countries who are, I guess, charged with responding to anything that happens to missionaries that are bad. But how the church treats its survivors, missionary survivors of things like sexual assault, has kind of been called into question as a result of this. Can you tell us how this was handled, how these cases were handled?
Right. So they each had sort of a different response, and that's been one of their big issues. When they met with each other, it was sort of a fluke that they connected through like a bishop's daughter who knew Camille, and the bishop was Maddie's bishop in Washington State. They started talking to each other, and as they discussed this trauma, they realized that there were gaps in how things were handled after the assault. In Maddie's case, the police was called. She went to the hospital. In Camille's case, the police were never called. She was not offered medical care. Once they arrived home in the States, Maddie received some outreach from the church. Camille did not for a period of about 3 months. Going forward, you know, due to these women's calls for change directly to the church, there is now a set protocol for how mission presidents should respond in the event of a sexual assault. That includes calling local authorities, arranging for immediate counseling services, medical attention, including, you know, testing for STDs or that kind of thing if there's been a sexual assault, and then working with the missionary to decide whether or not they should continue serving. In Maddie's case, she wanted to go home, and when she told that to her mission president, he said, I wish you wouldn't. And she felt like she had to kind of insist on going home. Camille, on the other hand, came downstairs the next morning after this assault, and her mission president said, you know, we made this decision, you're going home. And she really wishes that she'd been part of that conversation, and she was really sad to be leaving the mission. It was sort of a devastating moment to have that cut short and have that be another decision that was entirely out of her control.
Those are two completely different responses, right? I mean, you mm-hmm. have one in which someone is being involved, or not involved, but wants to stay and is being sent home. I guess in both instances, neither of them are being allowed to have sort of agency or to be able to make their own decisions about this.
Right.
And then in terms of the kind of support that they got when they did get home, I mean, from the institutional level, from the church, this is something that they felt was lacking as well. You kind of touched on this already, mm-hmm. but they get home and it kind of starts to dawn on them what they've been through.
Right. And, you know, when you're a missionary, you are 100% in the mission. You're not calling home. You're sending, you know, one email a week. Every part of your life is dictated by the mission. And, you know, in good ways and bad, you're forming these connections with people you're teaching. You have a really close relationship with the people around you. And then to be sent home after something so traumatic, you're just sort of, snapped out of this world. And not having that kind of connection was really difficult for both of them. Camille's mission president called her within a few days of her receiving home, but then never reached out again. And the expectation at the time was that all early returning missionaries, get 6 free sessions through LDS Family Services, which uses the gospel as a cornerstone of its teachings. And that wasn't helpful in a lot of ways for neither Camille nor Maddie. And Camille has had to fight to have her counseling paid for by the church and have it be sort of an unlimited of her choice counseling. There seemed to be an expectation that a few sessions would sort of fix what was wrong.
So there's a lot of things that they want to see change. They realize in these discussions that they have with each other that there are these gaps, and they begin to reach out to the church to try to get something done. And this is kind of part two of your series. You touched on some of the changes that the church says that it's instituting now. Are those changes the result of the advocacy of these two women? And can you just maybe further explain what those changes are in policy?
Yeah, you know, Elder Brent Nelson is the director of the missionary department. He took over in 2015, kind of around the time that Camille was reaching out to the missionary department. And he says that, you know, he was realizing that they had a lot more sister missionaries serving after they lowered the age to be able to serve, and that they had some issues with assault. And he says that the hearing from Maddie and Camille, hearing them describe what did and did not happen for them, made them see that there were gaps, that they weren't doing a good enough job, and that they need to do better. So it's clear that their feedback and their concerns really did lead to the formation of this protocol for mission presidents to follow.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned just the number of women going into the field as sister missionaries. Mm-hmm. That's new. I mean, there weren't as many just a couple mm-hmm. of years ago or a few years back now. Policy changes enacted inside the church said we're going to send a lot more female missionaries into the field. You can imagine that Latter-day Saint missionaries who have been going into countries since very early on in the church's history have experienced trouble before. It's 2018 now. Is this just not on the church's radar, or was it not on the radar for women in particular?
I think both. There's long been a culture in the church of sort of what happens on a mission stays on the mission in some ways. You know, there was an expectation for a long time that you don't write home negative things to your family, that when you give your homecoming talk in church, you're not supposed to dwell on negative experiences. And so there was sort of a culture of silence where if something did happen to someone that was serious, it was sort of like, well, that happened. That was me. That was my fault because there's a special protection that I should be having, and if something happened to penetrate that, maybe that was my fault.
I mean, that's interesting, the idea that that missionaries are protected, that bad things essentially can't happen to them, unless it's by their own volition or whatever. Can you talk about that? It's a myth that now the church is trying. Well, a myth. It's something that the church is trying to sort of dispel.
Right, right. So there's long been sort of a phrase that that the mission field is the safest place in the world. Statistically, young people around the world are in danger. You know, they're experimenting with things. They're going off to college. In some countries, they're going off to war. And so if you're looking just at the spectrum of young people who are out serving missions, you know, the rate of violence is lower. But that's a broad statistical number. That sort of has morphed in some ways, you know, from missionary to missionary, you know, local leaders saying, you are safe if you are on a mission. And Elder Nelson kind of says that's something that we are trying to dispel. They're producing safety videos that missionaries and their parents can watch beforehand to sort of say there are real risks in the mission field and you might get hurt, you know, in some ways here, and it's you don't have a special protection.
How about, I know that one of the concerns that Junca had in particular was about going back to Guerrero, the Mexican mm-hmm. state that, you know, the State Department you reported in your article was issuing warnings telling Americans to avoid the place at all costs, but the church was still sending missionaries there. How about in terms of where the church is sending people? Is that something that is part of these policy changes?
So early on, they said that they part of this new committee that they formed, the Sister Safety Committee, would be looking at new guidelines for where to send sister missionaries and higher guidelines. I was unable to kind of get more details on that. They did send a survey last year to all missionaries, asking them if they felt safe and what kind of things they'd experienced from groping to muggings and all of that. And once they got those results, they sent more surveys out to people who had reported sort of specifically high or levels of those things. And I think based on that, they might be reconsidering where to send people. But as of today, or you know, maybe as of 2 days ago at least, there are still missionaries serving in 5 Mexican states that are on the do not travel list
from the State Department.
Yes.
How are these two women, Junca and Sicot, how are they reacting to what the church is doing? I mean, they've been kind of working with they've reached out to the church's legal departments mm-hmm. essentially and helped effectuate these changes. How are they reacting to what's happening?
You know, I think that they see the changes that have happened so far as promising. They don't feel like they go in far enough. You know, that the fact that there are still missionaries in Guerrero and all those other states is still very concerning. And how they were personally treated, you know, they had an open dialogue with the church for a while, but that communication sort of dried up. And they feel like the church sort of said, you know, we don't want to hear from you anymore. And that was hurtful. You know, it was an institution that they trusted and loved, and they kind of felt like when they tried to work those changes from within, they were sort of dismissed. But the changing safety standards so that other missionaries can be protected was their ultimate goal.
So. Okay. Mm-hmm. I want to bring the voice of Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke in on this story. And Robert, it's really impactful reporting from Rachel Piper about the experience of a couple of women, but also what that means about the safety of missionaries around the world that members of the church send out. And it's a kind of mark of a rite of passage for a lot of Mormons. You know, how does the response of the church compare to how other sort of, I don't know, difficult situations for people or other institutions have responded? I mean, it's not the same sort of thing because they're talking about safety as opposed to something from inside. But
well, let me start, I guess, by saying Rachel's reporting was fantastic on this. And if you haven't read the story, I'd strongly encourage you to go do it. These missionaries can be in dangerous situations, obviously. I mean, I have several friends who served missions and had, you know, life-threatening encounters along the way, and we've, you know, reported on some who've been killed in the field. And I think particularly with the sister missionaries that Rachel's reporting on here, there's additional risk involved, right? So, I mean, women, generally speaking, have are at risk from different situations more so than men. So I think it's a little surprising, frankly, that the church hadn't taken this into consideration previously. Or didn't have, you know, a more rigorous set of rules in place for these, how these mission presidents should handle this and how they respond to it. Because yeah, these situations are going to happen. And I think with more sister missionaries going into the field, it's going to become increasingly common. So I think it's important that they're doing it, and it's good that they're doing it. It probably should have happened before, but I think these two sisters bringing this to light and being courageous enough to tell their stories has probably brought about a needed change in the church.
Rachel, it is really remarkable reporting, and kudos to you for telling the story and to these young women for telling their stories. Can I ask a question that's probably more of interest to the journalist than it is to everyone, but how did you find Hunca and Sikot? How did this story come to be?
So last summer, Maddie Sikot called me. She had gotten my information from someone that she met at BYU after, in the wake of sort of our BYU sexual assault reporting. So it sort of really stemmed from that. And yeah, we've been working on it since.
I'm sorry, I've been calling her Sikot the whole time when her first name is obviously Maddie, but thanks very much. Matt Canham, any comments on the story before we head to a break?
No, just what Robert said. This is a tremendous piece of journalism. It is a little bit of a longer piece of journalism, so go make out a little bit of time.
Set aside a little time.
When you start reading it, you will not stop. It's
true.
Amazing.
It's true. Impossible to put down. Rachel Piper, thanks very much for this.
Thank you.
We need to head to our first break of the show, but when we return, members of a Utah-based polygamous group are indicted in a tax credit scheme, raising questions about a donation to Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, Digital News Editor Rachel Piper, and News Columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can post them at the KCPW Facebook page. Matt Canham, the Kingston Group is a polygamist group in Utah. Over the past couple of years, members of that group have been in the news because of some legal troubles. And this past week, there were indictments related to a company some Kingston family members run. Tell us about these indictments. First, they have to do with allegations of fraud to a certain extent. Tell us what these indictments are.
These indictments are connected to Washakie Renewable Energy. And you might have heard of this company because in about 2010, it sprung up out of nowhere and seemed to be advertising everywhere. They were all over the jazz games. They were all over the Megaplex movie theaters. They were giving away college scholarships. They were also donating to political candidates. And their business model essentially was they took used cooking oil and made biofuel out of it, thousands and thousands of gallons of it. And there's a federal tax rebate if you did that. For every gallon, you could get 50 cents or a dollar. And over the course of almost six years, they got $511 million in this federal tax rebate. Now, what federal prosecutors are saying is the problem with this is that they didn't actually make the fuel. They made a little bit. They bought some. They moved it around to make it seem like they had it, but they didn't really have it. And so there was a raid in 2016 that we could talk a little bit more about because that's kind of interesting in its own. But what happened this last week is that federal prosecutors indicted Jacob Kingston and his brother Isaiah, as well as an outside businessman from California who's been involved in this, for this alleged tax scheme. And that's the big shakeup that we've been waiting for a couple years now.
To see what was going to happen. So the implication is that they're gaming federal renewable energy tax credits, falsifying records to get a payout from the government.
Right.
This is where they're making their money. And they were, pretending to create biofuels, but they weren't, or they were just doing it on a very small scale?
They did it on a small scale. They have a plant in Box Elder County. They did make some. We have some. If you look at the stories that Peyton Harkins and Nate Carlisle wrote, the Salt Lake Tribune has some nice photos of Jacob and Isaiah outside of their plant looking like they're pumping biofuels. So they did create some. But at some point, you know, this business became – more about buying other people's biofuels and moving it around than actually creating it.
This is what the government is alleging.
Yeah.
This, and again, you mentioned this 2016 raid, Matt, where these brothers, where a bunch of documents were seized. We learned this week in court documents that these brothers were allegedly tipped off to that raid. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we had. So there's a hearing this week that Nate Carlisle covered about whether these two Kingston brothers should be held in custody or allowed to be released pending trial. And the federal government included a filing in that to say that it is their belief that the Kingstons got tipped off by someone about this raid, that shelves were emptied, that hard drives were wiped clean, that it was clear that something planned, you know, some removal of items happened in a hurry.
Who would have done that tipping off? I mean, somebody inside the
Well, in the document, they said that people close to Jacob Kingston said that he had contacts willing to provide them information about ongoing covert investigations. Hmm. They imply that he had someone inside of law enforcement.
Wow. Okay. That's there's also the idea that the Kingston brothers are a flight risk, that they might
right.
This is based on witness testimony. Where would they supposedly flee to, Matt?
Turkey. Apparently, the Washakie Renewable Energy had some investment in Turkey. From the Turkish government, there's a news release about this investment. The brothers apparently have told people that they had houses there. One of them was arrested at the airport with his family on his way to Turkey. So this is something that's going to come up in hearings going forward about whether they should be released if clearly their plan was to flee.
What is this? I mean, is there a deeper tie, this polygamist family, the Kingston family, to Turkey? Or how do we know how their interest or investment in Turkey came to be?
It looked initially to be an energy trading investment. I don't know if there's a tie with any sort of group, but we do know that the president of Turkey has promised not to extradite any Americans as long as an individual cleric and the East Coast remains in the United States. It's an international dispute between the United States and Turkey. So if you happen to be an alleged criminal in the United States and you got there, you're probably okay.
You're kind of free from extradition. I'm just going to extend the listeners, an invitation that is, to our listeners again to join this conversation. The number is 801-355-8255. Matt, there are also claims of witness intimidation in this case, or the potential for witness intimidation because of past statements made by the Kingston brothers?
Well, and this is not 100% clear, but what it looks like is the federal government expected witness tampering, and so they had some of their own sources go and offer to bully witnesses or destroy evidence, and the Kingstons took them up on it, not knowing that they were working for the federal government. So that's also something that's been in the federal filings. Yeah, this has been an interesting case so far.
The proceeds of this, you know, allegedly illegal activity that the Kingstons were involved in, how does how do investigators say that this money was spent? I know that a mansion is something that they're looking at seizing now.
And they did seize. This is, you know, obviously we don't know about where all that money went, but they did take Jacob Kingston's home. It was a $3 million, 14,000 square foot mansion in Sandy. They also took a car, a 2010 Bugatti Veyron that is only worth $1.7 million.
Only. Huh. Okay. What do lawyers—
And it runs on biofuel, right?
Exactly.
weighing in. What do the lawyers for Isaiah and Jacob Kingston say? I mean, they're represented separately, right. We should say. They're essentially saying this is all overblown, that they're being treated unfairly.
So we've heard from Isaiah's Kingston's lawyer. He is the chief financial officer. We haven't heard much from Jacob, who's the CEO. But Isaiah's attorney, Scott Williams, is saying, look, this is a failed business. That's what this is. It's not this big organized crime thing that people are trying to make it out to be. That Isaiah has no criminal history, that he should be let, you know, out, and that this is a white collar crime case involving a company that just couldn't keep up with what its expectations were.
And they're entering not guilty pleas, I guess, for
the right. And essentially, this early stage is just trying to see whether they're going to stay incarcerated during this trial or if they're going to be released. And that's where the arguments early on are going. If you looked at Isaiah, he says he has been diagnosed with a form of cancer that has not been disclosed, that his wife is going to give birth in 3 weeks, and he wants to get out of prison now.
Tying into this whole story is the fact that the company, you mentioned the fact that they had a big profile here in town for a while, Washakie Renewable Energy. They have made some sizable political donations in Utah, including one really big gift to the political campaign of Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes. And Matt, can you tell us about that?
$50,985, broken up over different chunks, that has gone to the campaign of Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes. They did donate to other candidates, but much smaller amounts. The Republican Party got $27,500. The Utah Governor Gary Herbert got $15,000, and then some state lawmakers got smaller amounts. But the biggest chunk, easily the biggest chunk, went to Attorney General Sean Reyes. Now, when the raid took place in 2016, obviously those contributions became a question. And Sean Reyes decided at the time to put the money into escrow, essentially just to hold it in a savings account to see what happened with this investigation. He didn't really give us any sort of indication of how he would determine what he was going to do with that money, whether he was going to spend it, whether he was going to donate it or give it back. He just said he was holding on to it at that time, pending more information. So when the indictment happened, reporter Benjamin Wood called and asked, is this the more information you were looking for? He was referred to the attorney general's campaign manager, Alan Crooks, who called the question stupid. He said, I'm giving you zero comment, nothing, not even a no comment. It's a ridiculous question. Now, I wasn't in this conversation. My guess is that Alan Crooks is trying to say that an indictment is not a guilty plea and that they're waiting, but didn't say that. Instead, just was
no
hostile.
Not even a comment about the comment.
Yes.
Okay, so... So the donation has been isolated by the attorney general staff. You get this.
That's what they're telling us.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we don't have access to an escrow account, so that's what they've said.
I want to bring columnist Robert Gerke in on this. I mean, you could ask this question about any political donation, but is there an intent beyond supporting the candidates you like here? I mean, top law enforcement official, biggest donation made, legal troubles. Is there anything to be said about that, or is it just this is speech? I mean,
that's a ridiculous question, Roger. I'm not going to comment on that. I think it's an obvious question, and it's not a ridiculous one about the motivation. We don't know the motivation for Washakie to be giving money to the attorney general, but you know, you can probably be pretty, you know, make a pretty safe bet that it's not because they support his stance on biofuels, because that's not something that the attorney general does. So you think, yeah, you get to the next layer. Are they? And we've seen with the Shurtleff and Swallow scandal where donors were giving big contributions and getting favorable treatment from the attorney general's office. It's not unprecedented, it turns out. So, I think it's a legitimate question to ask. I think, you know, setting this aside into an escrow account is probably an adequate response for now. I mean, you know, they eventually, if they're convicted, you've got to then figure out what to do with it, because you don't return it to the criminals who took the money at that point. So you've got to find someplace else to put it. But yeah, I mean, look,
can I interrupt you for just a second and ask a question about the candidate responsibility when they get they get donations like this? Is it their responsibility to screen where the money is coming from?
Well, yes, it should be. I mean, they and Attorney General Reyes in particular, when he came into office, said that he was going to have the a transparent, open, ethical above board administration. They made a big issue about how they were rejecting donations from a number of that had been offered to them because they don't feel like it was appropriate for them to take donations from certain industries. In this case, you know, as Matt mentioned, Washakie at least on the surface seemed like an above board company. When I spoke to the governor about it this week and asked him what he was going to be doing with his money, he says every time they went up north, up to Brigham City, they would tour Washakie's plant. They would meet with him, and they were had access to those high levels of government. So, but they appeared to be above board, and it turns out that maybe they weren't. And you don't really necessarily blame the people who took the money, but yes, they do have some sort of. They should at least, look at who's giving them money. Why are they giving them money? Is a question that doesn't get asked often enough either. The motivation for to give these large sums of money to candidates.
Right. In general, in our political system, big donors get special treatment, as you pointed out from past scandals. Just a quick question about, having this money in your campaign coffers. What actually is Sean Reyes' next campaign? Is it a re-election campaign?
Wow, that's a good question. it could be a re-election campaign. There's been rumors he's interested in running for governor. He is a politically ambitious member of our civic life here, so I don't think he's intending to go away anytime soon. But, kind of back to the point on campaign contributions, we've seen in Utah and nationally that who you take money from and what happens when they get in trouble is often a sign of what that candidate stands for. And we've seen that in the past in Utah, where individual politicians will not take money from Energy Solutions, as an example, a company that is a nuclear waste dump in Tooele County. They don't want to take money from that. You've seen candidates say, I'm not going to take money from corporations or whatever. It shows the values of the politician as much as anything. And so a question about that from the the top law enforcement officer of the state of Utah, when a major campaign donor gets federally indicted, is not a stupid question.
Yeah, but values don't pay for campaign advertising, Matt.
There's two things. I think at this point the attorney general would probably be well advised to donate the money. Just get rid of it, wash his hands of it, and try to move on, because right now it's going to keep hanging over him as long as his trial keeps going on. And the second thing is I can still not think of a good legitimate reason why we have an elected attorney general who takes campaign contributions anyway. I think it should – I've thought for years it should be an appointed position. The governor should appoint. Senate should confirm. And then you get away from this issue where the attorney general has to be out hustling for dollars, and you get away from these conflicts that are – inevitably going to arise when a big campaign donor gets caught with their hand in the cookie jar.
Some change of policy suggestions from Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke.
When I'm governor, that's what we're going to do.
Yeah. Right, vote Gerke, everybody. Yeah. We need to head to our next break of the show. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, calls for public meetings of subcommittees of the Inland Port Board fall on deaf ears. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Rachel Piper, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us by calling 801-355-8255 with your questions and comments. Matt Canham, the Inland Port Authority Board, from its inception, has faced a certain degree of scrutiny, criticism even, how the board came together, conflicts of interest of board members. Those were a couple of issues from the outset. Last week on this show, we talked about meetings held by subcommittees of this board. People were upset that those meetings were not happening in public. This week, despite that public outcry, the Inland Port Board doubled down on that decision. Can you tell us what they decided to do?
Yes, on a vote of 9-2, they're going to keep these meetings private. And let's talk a little bit about what they're talking about in these meetings. Mm-hmm. The Inland Port, if you have not heard of this, is a massive piece of land in the northwest part of Salt Lake City near the airport that the state wants to turn into a shipping and distribution hub, which means that rail will bring shipping containers right from the California ports. Cargo will be flown in from the airport. It'll be trucked throughout the western United States. This is supposed to be the biggest economic project in the state's history. It's a major deal for policymakers. And it's also a major deal for environmentalists who don't think this or who think this project, if it moves forward, should have some very strong safeguards on it. And because of that, there's been lots of controversy on its creation, and there's been a lot of quick movement on how they do this. Well, we get to the point where this board, over the objection of the mayor of Salt Lake City, Jackie Biskupski, gets created. They're going to have – they have their first meeting, and then the decisions are really happening in these subgroups. Who's going to be the executive director? How do they handle the tax money they get? What – how do they deal with their budget or their rules? All the big decisions are happening in these small meetings that are not posted. There is no public agenda. You can't go hear it. And then when it goes to the big committee, they get a summary of what happened, and then they approve it. And there are people, including the governor, who say that, well, maybe those things should be held in – at least should be open to people who want to attend. I mean, obviously, those don't sound like the most riveting meetings you've ever been to, but this is about our government. It's about our tax money. And they're arguing that Utah's open meetings law allows them to avoid disclosure on meetings where there's not a quorum.
Right.
And so that's what they're trying to hang their hat on. They got a lot of public pressure to reconsider. Their chairman, Derek Miller, who is the Salt Lake Chamber leader, who is a very close political ally to the governor, was one of two to vote for opening it up, but nine members voted to keep this closed.
Those nine members, what is the justification they are giving for keeping the meetings closed? I mean, you said – you pointed out the fact that it's not, you know, under the open meetings law right. or act that they don't have to do it, but that doesn't mean that they – can't do it. I mean, right?
Yeah, they definitely could, which is why they could take a vote. But they're – I mean, I'm not trying to be flippant, but apparently the rule or the decision that reporter Taylor Stevens reported on was that they don't want to, and they think doing so would slow down their work because then people would know what they're talking about.
Hmm. At this point in the process, what is this board actually trying to accomplish? I mean, you mentioned, you know, they've appointed an executive director. They've made decisions about taxation. Now, what is the board actually trying to do?
Well, that's the thing. They're just starting that process. When you create this big of an organization from scratch, you are creating these rules and how do they govern themselves. And so we are at the starting point here. And then you are going to get into how do you build it? What environmental laws do you actually follow, and how do you follow it? And all this is a huge undertaking, and so they want to move very rapidly. There are people who are more concerned and want to hear how this is going to unfold, and so essentially they are trying to figure out the ground rules they're going to live under.
Columnist Robert Gerke, they want to move rapidly. This board wants to act really quickly. Why the rush? What I mean is something that should be happening? You're the columnist. You get to opine.
Well, I mean, I don't know that time is necessarily of the essence. I get that they want to move this in some expeditious manner, but you know, they may be correct that they don't have to. They don't legally have to open these to. I mean, they are a taxpayer funded body, and they are created by, you know, a public entity. So normally that, yes, they would have to be public meetings, but with these subcommittees that, you know, don't actually have voting authority, then I guess there's a legitimate argument to be made they don't. The issue, though, is that this body, this entity that was sort of created in the dark is now trying to stay in the, you know, keep things in the dark. And they should, I think, for the sake of public confidence, be trying to incorporate people and have public input and bring people in. I think it sets a bad precedent when they're, you know, right out of the gate, their first instinct is for nine of these 11 members is to try to shut down, you know, the public transparency of the whole thing. I think it would do them a lot of good, frankly, because there's suspicion of this entity in the first place. It would do them a lot of good to say, throw the doors open, you know, here's what we're going to do. You know, we want to hear from you. We want you to be involved, you know, but instead they sort of go to this sort of knee jerk reaction of trying to go into these back rooms and come up with their own plans themselves.
Here's an expression of frustration on this topic from comments from the comments section at sltrip.com. A commenter with the handle on Barad Time writes, "We endured countless campaign promises that transparency was a core value among Republicans. Does anyone know which Republican in office is working on that? ? Matt, I suppose it should be pointed out that this is this board, at least on paper, is nonpartisan, right? I mean, it's not a it's not made up of people who are it's not meant to be a partisan thing.
It's not meant to be a partisan thing, but it is created in the state of Utah, so right. It does lean Republican heavily, just by the members who are selected on it. But I will say that the state or the city was interested in doing a similar thing. The difference is, they want more environmental controls than they think the state's going to put on it. But the city's plan for this area was not wildly different from what the state's trying to do. They just want to make sure that if we're moving coal through this area, that it's in containers that are sealed so there's not coal dust blowing into West Side neighborhoods. Now, that might end up happening, but if it is, it's going to be debated in a meeting that you're not going to know about and then voted on by the full board.
No, you'll know. I suppose you'll know about it after the board votes on it.
Well, you'll know that's on the agenda when the board's going to vote on it. But the chance to craft that policy likely will be largely done beforehand.
And we've seen similar things happen in the legislature where they go into a closed caucus, they debate it in the closed caucus, and then they come out and do this show vote, basically, where there's not any legitimate debate or discussion or input because it's already decided at that point. And that's what we're going to get here. The actual work is going to be done behind closed doors. And frankly, the thing that's probably more disturbing about it is that there are going to be people who have access to those board members that aren't, you know, I'm talking about lobbyists, corporate interests, you know, that sort of thing. And the public won't have that same degree of access. And so the decisions, again, are going to be made in this star chamber, and then we'll get to see how they vote, I guess, at some point.
Yeah, we'll keep watching if we can, I guess. Guys, I want to
keep watching nothing, right?
Yeah, I want to get to a couple of more stories before we head to our underplayed stories of the week, our final segment of the show, or at least one more story anyway. And maybe we can turn to another story involving Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes. Matt Canham, the state of Utah wants the U.S. Supreme Court to review a federal ruling involving LGBTQ rights. This is about a case in Michigan, about a funeral home, and it has to do with the firing of a transgender employee. What is the Utah Attorney General, and I guess what are the other AGs from these other states trying to do here?
So Utah is one of 16 states that signed on to this into this legal writing in this case. And what they're trying to do is get the courts to say that it's Congress's job to define the word sex in the law and not the courts. What it comes down to is they think that protections when it says sex mean biological sex only and not someone's gender identity, which is what a court has ruled in this case. And this is something that is obviously one of these heated issues in our country now, and the Republicans are not as open to those protections, at least some. The interesting part of this case is that Utah has these protections.
Right.
And there was a big grand bargain that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was at the table for. And what Reyes is doing goes against what's Utah law, which is something that some Utah groups find interesting. And what he even points out in a post he put online is that it doesn't, whether even if he wins this, it has no bearing on what would happen in Utah. He says this is a narrow thing. It's about who gets to make the laws of the land. He wants it to be Congress and not courts. And that's what he's saying he's trying to accomplish. But there are groups who think if they do this, it will hurt people.
I mean, it's interesting because Congress's job to make the law, of course, the court's job to interpret the law, and that's what's happening. And this is now advocacy to a certain extent. But that's also the job of the Attorney General's Association.
That's true.
Robert Kirky, your comments on this story.
I mean, it's great that Sean Reyes has solved all of the other problems in the entire state, that he can start worrying about Michigan's gendered protections now. Look, it's true. It doesn't affect Utah, so I don't know why Utah is necessarily getting involved in this. And, you know, it does seem to be, it seems like sort of a petty thing for him to be, but it's he's a politician, I guess, and, you know, and this will probably play well to his base in terms of, you know, I guess his base maybe wants people to be able to be fired because of their gender identity. Maybe that's the long-term objective in this, but, you know, it's totally unnecessary for Utah, the state of Utah, taxpayers of Utah, to be involved in this lawsuit.
You know, since we have just a little bit of time left in the show, there's a story that is, well, I guess at least vaguely related to this, that I suppose we'll end on today, and that is that a Salt Lake County Republican Party spokesman made some statements about the LGBTQ community last week to the Tribune that drew a lot of criticism, and we didn't cover it on the show then, but Gerke, in your column this week, you addressed it. You expressed a columnist's frustration at no action having been taken in the wake of these comments. First, remind us what these comments were all about.
Well, Dave Robinson is now the spokesperson, the official spokesperson for the Salt Lake County Republican Party, and he came down and met with this Salt Lake Tribune's editorial board, I believe it was a week ago last Tuesday. And you know, during the course of this, the mission was to talk about the priorities of the party, and Dave kind of went on this tangent about how he believes that gay men are killing themselves because they have grundles of sex, as he put it, and then feel remorseful about it and take their own lives. And there was a blowback about this because there is a real problem in our community, A, with suicide. Utah's suicide rates are 60% higher than the national average. And it's especially among the gay community, it's even higher. So, but the concern is that he's making these statements that are not supported by facts and stereotyping an entire segment of the community, making the gay community appear like, you know, they're sex-crazed deviants, right? So there was a call for his removal.
Who made that call?
Well, primarily I would say it was Senator... State Senator Daniel Thatcher, Salt Lake County Council Chairwoman Amy Winder Newton, some other you know, prominent Republicans, candidates and office holders. Senator Howard Stevenson was among them.
But that hasn't happened. This dismissal has not
happened. It hasn't happened. We're now 10, 11 days into this, and the county chairman promised to listen to his delegates and have an online survey. That online survey may be happening. I was told this week it was not happening, and now it may be happening. So, again, he's, you know, it seems like this, you know, that there's not going to. Senator Thatcher told me the other day that he's very frustrated that the chairman hasn't taken responsibility for this and done something, because the concern is, you know, that by deviating into this sort of tangent that Dave Robinson is taking us down, it distracts from the broader discussion, or the important discussion, about how to address suicide generally and in the LGBT community in particular.
Okay. Important always to highlight resources when we're talking about suicide, and the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. And Robert Gerke, you also mentioned the Trevor Project Lifeline in your column, 1-866-488-7386. We're out of time, and we need to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, and this is our chance to highlight stories that maybe warrant more coverage or just stood out for us. And Rachel Piper, since it's been a little while since we've heard from you, do you want to start?
If I call this underplayed, it's really my fault since I'm now over the website. But Bill Frost, a longtime City Weekly author, had his first Tribune debut this week. He wrote about radio and how Utah is sort of a bastion of alternative radio, thanks to X96, and all these stations always come in and say, we're more alternative and we're better alternative. And just, he looks at what even alternative music is. It's a fun read, and maybe it'll inspire KCPW to start playing alt music all day.
Alt music. We'll do a morning zoo show as well. Probably not. Okay, thanks for that pick, Rachel. Matt Canham, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
I'm going to highlight our colleague Thomas Burr, the Washington, D.C. correspondent, our D.C. bureau chief. He got the National Press Club's Regional Reporting Award last night. regional reporters are reporters in D.C. who report back to communities throughout our country. This is the fourth time he's won that prize. And the history of the National Press Club, no one's won it more than twice. So it's really impressive. And it's we have great D.C. coverage here. So keep reading what Tommy's doing, including a story later today about Orrin Hatch, Donald Trump, and Google. So
check it out, sltrip.com, and congrats to Tommy Burr as well. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
So this is a story Brian Maffley wrote yesterday, and it's something we're going to have to keep following, I guess. Energy Solutions is trying to get an exemption that would allow them to dispose of these armor-piercing munitions. They have depleted uranium is what's sort of at the core of this. And environmental groups are concerned that it's radioactive. It's higher level than what they are officially allowed to take. But the company's seeking this exemption. And of course, whenever Energy Solutions is involved, it becomes, you know, also a question of politics and campaign contributions, as we've talked about earlier. So it's worth reading and worth continuing to keep an eye on.
Brian Maffley's story at sltrip.com. That's Robert Gerke's pick for underplayed story of the week. I'm going to go with a story from the Tribune's Tony Semirad that officials say that plans to revive or to preserve a 100-year-old theater on Main Street in downtown Salt Lake City are not viable. It's part of an ongoing story about the Utah Theater. Some great details from Tony's reporting, including the fact that this theater hosted touring acts like Abbott and Costello, Will Rogers, and baseball legend Babe Ruth before it became a movie hall in the 1930s. Anyway, check out that reporting and all of the coverage that we've been talking about today at the Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, and Rachel Piper, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today, you guys.
Thank you.
That wraps up our show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to the staff of Utah Public Radio in Logan, and to the show's producer, Emily Means. And thanks, as always, to you for tuning in. Hope you have a great holiday weekend. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.